This is the Skirted Roundtable. I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings.
And this is Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8.
Joni Webb with Coat de Texas.
This week on the Skirted Roundtable, we're welcoming architect and interior designer Bobby McAlpin, who has designed just some of the most amazingly beautiful homes, and there's a huge buzz about you being on our show. So, Bobby, thank you so much for joining us at the Skirted Roundtable.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're excited to talk to you about your career and about your new book, The Home Within Us, which just has some incredible properties and rooms and decoration. So the first thing we always like to talk to people about is your background and you know, where you grew up. And I think I read in your book you designed your first house at the age of 5?
Yes.
Wow. Tell us, start there.
That's easy. I grew up in a series of sawmill towns, and as a child, I didn't really recognize where I was. And so I sort of went inside, and I paved a paradise in there. And as the luckiest boy in the world, I got to put it outside of myself later on in life and paint other people's dreams with it.
And so did you, you went to architecture school, obviously.
I did. I went to Auburn University. It was a state school, and I didn't know any better. And it turns out it was a really good school, and I taught there for 9 years after I graduated. And I staffed my entire office with all of the finest people who ever went through there. So I'm all about that.
And did you focus on the exterior structures first and then start moving into interiors, or was it always a really holistic approach for you?
It's always interior for me. Always. I could give you a really long answer. Do you have time?
Sure.
Yes.
When you're a kid and you're being raised in a sawmill town and you don't recognize anything around you as being remotely familiar, you kind of go inside and you create a world inside there. And so you create a pretty well-decorated vault of information and imagination. And so when I, as an adult, am asked or am commissioned to design something, I first set up camp on the site on a beautiful piece of land or a not-so-beautiful piece of land. And I think about where would I set myself up and how would I, where would I build the fire and where would I sit my furniture? And so the architecture really comes as an afterward kind of thing. It is a later consideration and a later evolution of things. I don't worry what things look like or how beautiful they might be. I don't see houses or architecture as objects or entities or whatever might be another classical adjective for that. I see that my consideration is born out of intimacy and what can I do to bring us all toward that all the time, constantly, and then what could edify afterward in architecture. So it comes, it's the very last consideration.
So it's like you build the heart and then you build the body around it.
Yes, exactly. It's like if you ask a girlfriend who had a little baby, you go like, what'd you have? She goes, well, I had a little doctor. And you go, no, you didn't.
Oh, yeah.
You can't paint that all over that child. You know, what you had was a possibility, somebody that has something else. And so these houses are always born of some kind of DNA that's recognized through interviewing and assessing who's in front of me. And if you get the DNA right, then it will answer every single quotient that follows it. Every question, all of that.
So what sort of process do you go through when you initially begin with a client or a prospective client?
Well, I love for them just to talk to me, you know, basically, and certainly physically showing up in front of me and showing me their property. You know, that's certainly part of it. But so many times they don't quite know what to say, but they're always saying it in their clothes and their posture and their looks and their everything. There's a silent reading that goes on that is informs me, possibly, if I'm on a good day, knowing what is in front of me.
We, in the past, have talked to designers about when they meet with a prospective client, if 100% of the time you're going to take on that job, or do you need to sit and make sure that you can work with them, that it's a kind of, it's going to work, you know, it's a good fit for you and the client. Do you go through any process like that, or do you just take it on and move on from there?
Am I a whore?
What?
Well,
what did you say?
He said, am I a whore?
Oh. All right.
The answer is yes, I am. But I'm a hard whore to find. I live in Alabama.
How high class.
A very inconvenient trick. You know, anybody who goes to the trouble of calling up Bobby McAlpin has probably been tracking him for a while. I'm a long-tracked kill, and I'm not the guy at the country club. I'm not the guy in the Hamptons. I'm not the guy in New York. I'm a different guy. And so if you have gone to the trouble to consider me for a long, long time, no doubt, most likely when my phone rings, we're probably a pretty good match.
By the time if someone knows of you, they know how you work. They know what they're going to get from you. So they're not going to bring you on, and you're not going to have to worry about having them take control of really what you should be doing, which is why you're hired.
No, that's not right. I think that if somebody has gone to the trouble of finding me and braved the call to a place they'd never want to go in their life, Alabama, then they probably have done their homework, and they probably recognize something soulfully in the work that speaks to them that they can't speak of themselves. And it's been repetitive. It's come again and again, thank God, from all this publication for many, many years. And they see something.
You've met with the client and you've a little bit lived on the property to get the sense of placement. Do you do the, you know, a whole scale plan and then present it to the client from the outside or from the inside out? Or, you know, how does it, what's that meeting, that next meeting with the client like about, you know, this is the vision?
Well, when I'm on site and I've heard them speak and I've heard what they want, 99% of the time it comes in a flash, and I will put it out there and I'll draw it and I'll put it in front of them right that minute, and they can respond to it. Because what my goal is, because I'm very efficient, I really want to, my heart and my gills are wide open, and what I want to happen is for them to respond immediately, so that when I walk away that very night in that airport or that hotel room or wherever I am, that I can spend the night petting on those thoughts and bringing them into some kind of maturity, because it's all fresh.
Mm. And because you've already gotten a little feedback from them as far as, you know, presumably positive, yes, I love that idea kind of thing.
Exactly. I don't want to ever leave them in a mystery, that they don't know who they've hired or where I'm headed, what road I'm going down. I'd really like to be that quick, and it mostly always is that quick.
Bobby, I was curious. You mentioned that you have had an enormous amount of publicity, thankfully. When a new client comes to you, what is your most popular, is there one house that people say over and over and over they want a house that looks like that? Is there one of yours that is more popular than the others?
It goes in sort of 5-year cycles, you know. Certainly through the 80s, it was anything sort of French country, and then it was anything sort of Tuscan or Italian. These days, it's maybe even something American. So it drifts with trend, sort of, which I hate to say, but I am such a chameleon, and I turn the exacting color of green that I should upon meeting you or any one of you. And I revel in that. I love that machinery. You know, I sort of address it and roll around in it and make it happen.
Mm-hmm. So there's not one house that you've created that most clients say, oh, I loved that house and I want that house or something like that. They always want something new from you?
They sense something, I think, from me, I hope. That is that I might be the soothsayer for them, you know. And I hope always that no one would want me to repeat a thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not a classicist. I'm not someone who's trying to create a style and ram it down anybody's throat. I'm much more interested in listening and meeting people and doing things that are new because it's my university.
What do you mean by it's your university?
It means that I'm in a learning organism of thought, and by invitation of different people and different pairings of couples and contradictions and all of that mixed breed of situation, I'm really taxing my machinery to try to make something out of what I see, and I love that. I'm not trying to build a case for something or say this is my style.
You know, I love your interiors. I love the way that you decorate, I guess is the proper word. Do you prefer decorating or being the architect?
Well, if I died tomorrow, I would prefer to be known as an architect. Mm-hmm. It really is what I am. Mm-hmm. I am an interior designer by defense because my interiors sometimes just get wasted on perhaps not the right talent. And so I do it
was it kind of?
Let me ask you this. Have you ever designed like a gorgeous house and then you walk in and you see what they did with the furniture and you just wanted to cry?
Yes, absolutely. In the early days in the 80s, when I did some really very, very pretty work, I walked away knowing it was lost. And the fact is, in terms of and this is a commercial, hideous statement. If you want to be recognized as an architect, you have to have good interiors because that, up until now, has been the only mechanism for publication and furthering you, especially from Montgomery, Alabama, to the world. And so you can't afford misses and losses. And so I took it on, I took it by the horns, and I went there not just from that standpoint, but because I'm really passionate about it. I love it. I live in houses, and I've lived and thought of them, I've rolled in them all my life. And mm-hmm. I'd moved 19 times by the time I'd been to college, and I know how to...
You beat me.
Yeah, I know how to move and how to set up a house. I could have a cocktail party in 24 hours.
Bobby, I want to get your upbringing. Why were you moving so much? You all moved... I mean, that's an extraordinary amount of time. Was your father in the military, or...
No, he wasn't. You would think that. I've heard that before. He was a mill manager, and we just moved every 3 years. But within every 3 years, my mother was such a house whore, she found at least three houses that we should be living in, each better than the last one.
And I did read that in your book as well. She really shared your passion.
Yeah, she's incredible. She was incredible.
Yeah.
So I was her boy, you know, and I watched her do her work, and it was phenomenal how fast she could, you know, acquire and get us there and make it all happen. And so I'm a mover.
Did she give
you... I'm sorry, Lynn. I'm curious where you're living now. You had bought a house and didn't build it that you were living in a few years ago. Are you still there?
I bought a house. I bought several houses here in Nashville. And most recently, 4 years ago, bought a house to tear down and tore it down to build a new house, which I had designed. And then bought an interim house designed by a modernist architect, a German fella in his 70s now. And it overlooks, it's up in the woods on a steep hillside and overlooks downtown Nashville. And it's kind of fabulous. The architecture is like nothing I would have anything to do with, but to be in it is incredible. And so I realized that I was about to go live in the wrong place. And so I'm stuck for the moment in consideration of what's next.
Did your mother let you do your own rooms in your moving or other parts of the house?
Oh, she let me do her whole house.
Ah.
Several times. I mean, several times. Oh, yeah. I wore her out.
She had to keep moving to keep you interested.
Exactly.
Oh, that's kind of neat.
I was going to say, do you miss the house, that gorgeous house, the first house in your book that you lived in for a while? I think that's like one of my favorite houses ever. I mean, it's so fabulous.
That house was a self-portrait. It was totally me. And I do miss it. I didn't at the time have the kind of personal relationship that would make it whole. And so I built it, and it was a little bit hollow, and I redid it three different times from its interior, as you'll see in the book. Mm-hmm. There were dramatic differences each time. And I do miss it now, and I would give anything if I could fly it to the moon, you know, and have it be with me wherever I am.
Do you know who bought it, or do you know who's living in there?
Oh, God, yes. The great reward is my youngest, gorgeous partner, who's a sweetheart, Chris Tippett, who's so talented and has been, he was a student of mine, and he and his wife and children live there, and what was never there is there now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's lovely. So it's kind
so
of
you're
like...
You're saying you were single when you lived there, and now you're not. Is that what you're implying?
I'm double now.
Okay. Double.
Got it.
But that sounds a lot like, you know, you pass the family house down. You know, someone who works for you and...
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. No, exactly. And it's, you know, it... Of course, I passed a house down to a family that was a bachelor house, and so they are suffering with the woes of the house, let me tell you.
How many bedrooms is it?
It's three.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. It's the cover of the book, y'all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
I think more than one person could comfortably live in this house.
Yeah.
And they are. I mean, they are. They're having a lovely life, and their kids are building a beautiful history there. And
now, you have more than one firm. You've got the McAlpin Tankersley Architecture in Alabama, and then you've got the McAlpin Booth and Ferrier Interiors, which is in Nashville and Atlanta. Do I have
that's
right?
That's fine. You are so on top.
And so how do you balance all that in the distance?
I wake up in the wrong town every day of my life. So I don't even try. I just I pretty much left the gates open and said, you know what, all of you, all of my partners, go live where you want to live, because our work is all over the place. And just pick a town and with a good airport.
Yeah.
And, you know, go live there.
And modern technology, yeah, you can do that.
Yeah, well, here we are on Skype.
Here we are, from all over the country.
That's right. Ask me something really hard.
Oh, boy.
Really hard. We're not necessarily hard question people here on the Skirt of Round
Table. This will be edited out, I can assure you.
Oh, I might keep that in. I could keep that in.
The blank space, while we're thinking of something.
Something smart.
I just want you to know I'm here at the party.
Well, okay. What do you mean by an American? You said that now the American house is... What would you describe as an American house?
Yeah, I wanted to ask that same question.
Oh, well...
I asked it, Linda, though.
I know you did, Joni. You get the credit.
Well, there has been such a long-lived courtship with Europe amongst Americans, or American wannabes, or European wannabes, all of us, who can't really afford to be. And I'm an architect, so I know all about that. And I think at some point, as in any kind of peak of Victorianism, which happened in the last of the last century, where the three little pigs, you know, built their house of sticks and bricks and wood and whatever, there was a great failure in the 1890s up into the 19-teens. And I'm sorry this answer is long, but we have gone there all over again. We have built a whole world full of white Lincoln Town Cars with opera windows and white vinyl Landau roofs and things that are uninheritable whatsoever.
And so, poorly designed, really. Designed by people who... There are all these builders doing these, trying to design a home, and you walk in and the space feels so uncomfortable, and no one knows where to place furniture because no one's really thought it out. They've just tried to cram as many angles as they can
and
square
windows,
footage.
And windows.
And windows, and none of it makes any sense.
No, it's like when Pontiac, you know, sort of came up with some kind of Catalina that had an opera window behind the opera window. You know, it was like they were using used parts.
Down to the part where, you know, you walk into an entryway in some of these newer homes that are being mass-produced in a matter of a month, and the banister is the first thing that greets you. And here you've got this banister that looks like it was picked up at the Home Improvement Center, you know, and it's in a huge home. I'm just so surprised that people aren't paying attention to these details, and they're using not very quality materials on top of it all, and that's not going to last.
No, it's not. You know, everything that becomes mature and becomes inheritable is subtle. And so if you are watching The Housewives of New Jersey, you know,
of course, are you kidding?
Then, you know, you're going to have all that. And you're not going to learn a thing in this world. And, you know, it takes a real strong and smart appetite to try to develop what's going to last.
No, I was just saying, so when you did talk about sort of the 80s was all about French country and the 90s was Italian, and then you said it's sort of more recently people sort of requesting a more American.
Yes.
How does that translate to what you can give people that feels more American? Is that what you were saying? Or
thank you for bringing that back, because I didn't really answer it. I meant to. What I say most routinely when I think about these things is that American is a dream sewn up in cotton. It's not silk or wool or stone or anything else. It's sewn up in a common material that is provincial, and it's lovely because it's so pure of heart, you know. And it's maybe a little lacking of resource, maybe a little lacking of background or credential or bloodline or whatever. But there's something lovely about it because we are a colony. And when Europe colonizes a country, its loveliest architecture shows up through the naivety of its natives.
How would you say that's translating into work you're currently doing? Is work you're currently doing substantially different than, for instance, what we see in the book?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I mean, what's in the book are 25 projects, and I've done 500, literally. And that's all that would fit between the covers. And what is in the works right now is some phenomenal stuff for people who are really, really braving new ground. We're talking about stone houses that ramble around courtyards with steel windows and thatch roofs and that are just the shit. Because
a thatched roof, really?
Thatched roofs?
Yes.
And who here?
Where?
In America?
What state?
Arizona.
And who tends to?
I mean, I have code. You don't have code for that.
I'm sorry, what?
You can get around code to do a thatched roof. You couldn't do it here in Houston.
Code didn't know what to do with it, so it's hysterical. It's funny. It becomes a non-qualifier. And how long does it last? Nobody knows.
Right. Well, you know, drive around England and you see these people up on their roofs poking away with these, you know, these three-pronged, their hose just going at it. I mean, who's taking care of, who comes by and waters it down and takes care of it?
You have to go on a program of care, you know, and
you have to, the owner has to teach themselves, or how does that work?
Yeah, exactly. You said it.
We have a store in Massachusetts called the Christmas Tree Shops, which is kind of like a dollar store, but a little nicer and a little more eclectic. And there's one right near me that has a thatched roof, and they've had it for years. It's sort of swish.
Off the 91 or whatever?
No, it's right at the Sagamore Bridge onto Cape Cod. And it's sort of a Swiss chalet kind of look. It's kitschy. There's no question. But it's cute. And it has thatched roof, and it's been on there so it's survived in New England. It survives New England winters.
I don't think I've ever known. Well, you know, they have them in the Cotswolds, and you get all kinds of weather. Is there a picture of a house with a thatched roof in your book? Did I see that?
I'm sorry?
In your book, is there a photograph of a house with a thatched roof?
Oh, yes. In fact, there's a passage that's important to read in there about what's important about the decision of putting the permanent and the perishable together, that it is a gorgeous choice because it is, it in fact mimics our lives because you choose love knowing it may not last, and you choose thatch, and you choose stone and steel and all those things. And
I do find that in your design, there's a home that you did that is both utilitarian and domestic I think is how you put it. And I do love that home, especially because you have done those juxtapositions. And there are these sort of utilitarian metal draftsman chairs, you know, pulled up to a wooden table.
Yes.
In a dining area.
Yeah, kitchen, probably.
Yeah, it's kitchen.
Yep, in the kitchen. Mm-hmm.
That was actually modeled after Edwin Lutyens' kitchen for Castle Drago.
You know, when I think of your work, there's a few things I think of. I think, there's many things, but I think of steel windows. I think you were one of the first that really pushed these gorgeous windows, steel. I think of you never having a set of dining room chairs. You know, they're always mismatched, or you'll have stools.
Yeah.
And you always have these gorgeous wood-framed chairs in your interiors. You know, just these gorgeous French, I guess, Louis XIII, maybe?
Well, chairs are people to me. I love chairs and shirts.
Shirts.
Collect them both.
Yeah. Well,
I bet you have 50 white shirts.
You know what? I'm pink with gray hair and blue eyes, so I can hardly wear any other color.
Yep.
Besides charcoal or gray or blue or white. So that's about it. As much as I love and practice olive green, I can't wear it. So, to answer your question, well, what's the question?
if you have a bunch of white shirts in your closet.
You were
wasn't the question. It was something better.
Well, I like your
steel fenestration obsession.
Yes, but you know, I do love it because I do love the sex of it. You know, that there's a way of pairing ancient, resilient, lovely, gorgeous, imperishable stuff with industry and loft elegance and all of that. That it's really, when somebody's got the bucks, I'm going to go there because really nothing replaces it. It's like the best eyeliner you ever put on your face. I mean, it is mascara. It is just gorgeous. And it's
gorgeous against, you know, wood. It's gorgeous against the stone. I mean, it works. It's my favorite detail that you do, I think.
It's a beautiful thing, and it's rare. It almost always gets bumped. I rarely get to do it.
Because of the price? Because it's got to be extraordinarily expensive. Yeah.
Expensive. Yes. It's ironic, as anything humble is. Humble is always the most expensive thing you can do.
What's your next choice if that gets bumped?
Dark paint.
Just fake it till you make it kind of look.
Yeah, you try to keep it thin and dark, and you try to paint the language in there, and you can do it. I mean, you know, you can get away with a certain amount of it, but nothing's like the real thing. So,
I think my favorite space in the book is the last one, which is called, which the chapter title is Humility. And I actually really enjoyed the chapter titles because they're so lyrical, but it's the sort of English, churchy, Cotswolds kind of space, but has lots of stone and iron. And
is it the chapel?
It's a chapel. Yeah. Is this a chapel or is this a house that looks like a chapel?
No, it's a chapel.
Hmm.
It's a chapel.
Because I could live there.
Yeah, I went through a period over 10 years, 10 years ago, where a particular patron commissioned me to invent things to build on his property. And he laughed at the amounts that it cost. He didn't care.
Huh.
He said, I want to litter basically, this campus with things that will make it lovely. But that particular commission was a gift to his wife, Carolyn, and he gave it to her on Christmas, which was a model and drawings, and then 1 year later was the real thing. And right now, they are both buried there.
I was going to ask, did they actually use it for some kind of services or just to reflective space?
No, they were sort of beyond the order of a graceful thing. You know, they had just drifted on into some other territory, and by the time it was complete, they got to enjoy it for a moment and saw it, and now they're buried in it. And their son, who is an architect, who actually connected me to his father, called me after the commission, which was so fabulous in the first place. He said, would you do my father's headstone? Mm. And so it is the first and the only one I've ever done in my life. And I found a double cross in my shopping that struck me. And I knew the love between the two of them was so connected and so tethered, like a root, that I had to design a headstone around a double cross. And so they are lying in the backyard of that chapel in a chamber, very humble, very probably unlike him, because he could have had anything. He could have been Mussolini under glass, air conditioned, you know. But ultimately chose me to represent him.
Well, is the property still owned by the family?
It is, but I think it's been given to the state of Alabama to possibly become the governor's mansion.
Wow.
Such an honor for you.
And I hope that happens, but no governor will touch it because it's too poisonous, even though it's free. You know.
What do you mean by poisonous?
Well, any politician, you know, can't really do anything that makes him have to go into a defense about it, you know, whether it's a gift or an appointment or whatever. So it's like there's so many battles to fight. Mm-hmm. And to move the governor's mansion from where it is in Alabama to a free, lovely place that's actually perfect would bring them to be unelected.
Politics.
Mm-hmm. It's politics.
Yeah, so why memorials take 50 years to build.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to touch on something that I've touched on my blog a lot, or a few times, I should say, but you keep, you know, money. You know, it all comes down to money. Mm-hmm. And I always think it's so unfair because money doesn't buy you taste. And people that have great taste but don't have the big bucks to have to steal windows. But, I mean, you know, it's... do you ever think about that, what I'm saying?
I sort of hear your question. Yes, of course I do. I don't court money and I don't worship it in any way. Of course it affords these great visions and things, but a life of design is basically a life of consideration. And if you consider things and you're smart and you're clever, it's not all that much about money. You know, designers don't make a lot of money. Any interior designer or architect that you're ever going to talk to are nowhere near in league with their clients. And they're not stars. They're not rich. They just live in consideration of such things. And some of them, not that many as you would think, but some of them actually live pretty gorgeous, rich lives that are exemplary, and because they care about it.
Let's say you had to make a choice, and the choice was for where you live, you could live in a gorgeous house designed by you, pretty much empty or just filled with, you know, hand-me-down furniture, or a regular space but filled with gorgeous furniture, which would be your choice?
Well, that's a conundrum. Let me think for a second. You know, I certainly would, as an architect, I would choose the space first, because especially if it's really, really right. If it's gorgeous, if there's some poetry, if there's something heartful in it, I would choose it, and then the rest will come to it. If I can't, in the interim, or whatever chapter I'm in my life, and we are all in very many chapters all the time, I would certainly decorate the fuck out of something that wasn't right and disguise it as mine through goods and fashion and stuff. And so we're in that rhythm, I think, you know, and what we seek in the end is, when does that all come together? I'm sorry I said fuck.
No, that's all right. There goes my, the clean rating on iTunes. That's all right. I think
you have to leave that in though.
I know. It's our first one, I think.
I like that.
That'll be the headline. Decorate the F out of space.
When it comes down to it, just decorate the fuck out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
What would you say of an interior space in the house? Do you have a favorite? Like your, I sort of noticed looking through your book, the entryways and transition spaces are really special, and outdoor, you know, the outdoor spaces that are rooms, the outdoor rooms, really struck me. But do you have, you know, a room that you particularly love in a house that you just always sort of feel the most kinship to?
No, I really don't. I love sequence, you know. I love for things to unfold, and so it doesn't really matter. What is really deeply important to me is that the minute you crack open the container, meaning the house, I want you to be destroyed. I want you to be disheveled by the level of intimacy. What's being offered you is got to bring you to your knees. And it's not to impress you. It is to tell you how badly wanted you are, and how long we've been waiting for you.
I love your approach. You know, at the beginning of the show, I approached you asking you sort of how you did this technically. How do you do this? How, you know, how do you go about the business of hiring your client, so to speak? And really what I'm learning and what I've learned is that you really don't approach it from that angle. You're really spiritually wrapped in and intertwined with the true essence of design, which is really incredible. And I think if one can master that and rein that in or understand that, then that's how a beautiful home is built.
Well, of course it is. I mean, I'm not a business. I do to survive, which has to do with if I did not practice this thought in all of these findings, it would just kill me. So it's a do or die thing. So from a little boy from a sawmill town who could only find a world inside to live, I have found a world outside of me in my adult life that has a lot of invitation, strange in particular, and that allows me to put my findings out there on a page, and also a lot of empathy, because wouldn't know how to say because, but it just comes from a place that is so appointed by me that when you come to me, I'm desperate to see you.
Do you keep in touch with most of your clients?
Some.
Yeah. I mean, just because it's sort of, there's such a heart and soul and spirit invested.
Only in these later years, the last 5 years probably, learned that these are not commissions and they're not exercises, but they are my life. And I am a different person than I was.
Bobby, is there anyone alive that inspires you, that when you see their work, that you are moved by it? Is that...
I'm not really inspired by what's outside of me, but what's inside of me. And so I can't properly answer that. I will always routinely say two people, one not alive and one alive. Edwin Lutyens, who was a brilliant and brave architect in England, and who was during the same very period that Frank Lloyd Wright became famous, he was in England doing this very conservative work, seemingly so, but actually it was very sneaky and very brave, and he was a bad boy under a big cloak, and I love his work so much.
This house on the cover seems very inspired by him to me.
It's inspired by the house he did for his mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only house I probably have ever done in my life that was inspired by an exterior image. And I loved it. And I recently toured it and through it. And it's... and mine is so much better.
I was gonna say, did it live up to?
No, wait. Finish the question. Yeah. Who's one that's alive, though?
The one that's alive, John Saladino.
Oh, I was hoping you would say him. I was hoping you would say him.
He thinks I knock him off. I'm sure all the time, but I don't. And we just happen to be similar. And I think he's a true gift, and since I was a college student, I've watched his work. I've worked with him, actually, and become his friend, and all of that, but I think he's one of the most overlooked people, out there.
I have to say, your book, reading your book, I think Saladino's books are fabulous, and I thought yours was the only one other design book that I ever got that feeling from. That's it's very well written, it's inspiring, it's interesting, it's intelligent, you can learn from it, it's gorgeous, it's really a beautiful book.
Well, thank you so much, I appreciate that. I poured my heart into it, and
it really shows.
I try not to embarrass myself too much, but I'm totally willing to.
How long did you work on the book?
Well, who knows? Years.
Years, yeah. A labor of love.
Well, it's not just a picture slapped together, which most design books are.
No, it is beautifully written. It's very thoughtful and thought-provoking.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, and I know you probably don't have much more time, but
The book
comes from the premise of the question that's put to me most often, which is, where do you get your ideas? Is it from your travels to Europe? Is it from what you've seen in your exposure and all that? And I look back at whoever says that, like a cow over a fence with the dumbest eyes they make.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only know, to answer the question, that no, I look inside I always look inside of me because that's where my wealth is and where my future is. Has been. And
well, I think it's what sets a true genius apart because, you know, you're creating where other people are following, you know, your lead. So
can I ask you a question about the Blount estate? Did you do any of their main house?
Blount.
Isn't that the name of the guy who did the with the chapel?
Yes, the Blounts. I did a conservatory for that house, and the house had been designed by a really great architect in New York in the 60s, and it actually was a very, very fine replica sort of a historic Georgian house. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to do an enormous, vulgar addition to it, which was a dining room to seat 100 people.
This is the invisible chapter.
I said, okay, I'm going to be the guy who ruined that house. And so I invented an aesthetic that was sort of a burned-down Elizabethan Flemish gabled thing re-executed in glass.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
And it became the dining room for the house. It did not ruin it. And hopefully, when it comes to Governor's Mansion, that'll be just the best dig in town. But you know, it was just that grand sort of turn of the century addition to the house, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it remains bizarre, but it actually is quite lovely. And
mm-hmm. Well, Bobby, thank you so much for joining us. This has been, you know, it's really fascinating to hear someone who has so much to do with every aspect of your projects, you know, just to hear the sort of inner workings of your thought processes. Always very interesting for us to talk about, and I appreciate your openness to talk to us about that.
Well, hey, I'm all yours. But thanks to you, and I so appreciate this, and I mostly am just entertaining myself with you.
So, we're glad we can entertain you.
I'm so glad we could.
We were all in the same place, wouldn't we have some fun?
This has been the Skirted Roundtable with Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8, Joni Webb from Cota, Texas, and I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings. And this week we were joined by architect and interior designer Bobby McAlpin. Thank you so much for joining us. You can visit us online at www.skirtedroundtable.blogspot.com or download our podcasts from iTunes. Search for the Skirted Roundtable. Thanks so much, and we'll be back soon.